Talk Shoes.
Recorded live.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, Pastor Eli James with William Fink, my guest host for all these episodes of Christogenos. And I'm going to start today just talking about briefly last weekend's events that I attended. First of all, I was a speaker at the White Nationalists of Illinois, and there were all kinds of white nationalists there. There were a few other identists, not too many, but I was able to get my point across. There were a lot of people there who were familiar with Waddell and his, you know, his writings about the Aryans that invaded Britain and Brittany and Ireland, et cetera, et cetera. And people like that, I mean, there's a lot of people there who actually do research in history, but of course very few of them understood the Bible, that those so-called Aryans are actually Israelites. And it was refreshing to meet many people there who were actually readers of Waddell and Sharon Turner, History of the Anglo-Saxons, et cetera, et cetera. Okay? So in my speech, since those people were there, I directed my speech toward clearing up the fact that those people, those so-called Aryans, are actually Israelites, and in many cases they're Hamites and Japhethites, not at all Edomites, or, you know, as the Jews would have us believe, that the Aryans were not Israelites, but they're hook-nosed, kike-receding forehead type of facial structure is Shemitic. And of course, we know that's not true. The Shemites and the Aryans are one and the same people. And I explained to them that's nothing but more Jewish lies.
And the Hittite monuments reveal that.
Okay.
Monuments that are clearly Hittite.
Okay, yes.
And they reveal that countenance.
Right. And
so if the Hittites are the Canaanites of the Bible, then they must be the hook-nosed people.
That's right. That's right. And all the monuments I'm aware of that depict Israelites show your typical Nordic Aryan face.
Right, and something that I wish I'd have spent a little more time on last week when we covered Genesis 10 was that we have sound proof that the Persians, who the Bible says are Shemites,
yes,
we have sound proof that they're entirely white people.
Mm-hmm.
And I put some of that proof on my website.
Okay.
I had put a quotation from Xenophon on my website today in preparation for this, and some Greek artwork, which is produced by Harvard. It was actually reconstructions of the painting. Greek sculpture was evidently all painted at one time,
mm-hmm.
and it was painted very lifelike. And the Greeks and the Persians depicted are as probably whiter than we are.
Right,
people are white.
Yes.
And there's no mistaking that the skin tones in the paint are purposeful and that these people are depicting holy Caucasian people.
Yeah, well, it's only until recently, I'd say, the last century, the 20th century, where it was fashionable for white women and white people in general to get suntans, to deliberately go out and get suntans, okay?
Well, women in those days were kept indoors.
That's right.
And because Greek
barefoot and pregnant, right.
Right, and because they were, and
yeah,
Greek women...
Right.
Greek women had a certain amount of time outside with their men to go to the market, and that was it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
just, can you imagine how little sun that the Muslim ladies, even though they live in a sunny climate, they got to wear these, I forget what they call them, burqas, I guess they call them, that the only thing exposed to the sunlight is their eyes?
Yeah, I don't think it was that bad in ancient Greece
and
ancient Rome, but
right.
there is clear... references in the Greek poets from the 5th century B.C.,
mm-hmm.
in Euripides and Aeschylus, that women were not even permitted to talk or lay eyes on a strange man.
Right, right. No, that's still true in the Muslim world today. That's absolutely true still, yes.
They were kept home, and that's because men in the Greek world worked naked, and the Phoenicians and the Romans, when they worked, when they did labor in the fields, they were nude.
Okay,
and we have evidence of that in the New Testament. Yahshua Christ takes his clothes off to wash the feet of the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
And he also, Peter, now this sounds crazy, but once you realize that they worked naked, it's understandable. Peter sees Yahshua walking on the water, gets up in the fishing boat, puts his clothing on, and jumps in the water.
Okay.
Right. That doesn't
make any sense at all. Right.
Unless you understand the culture.
Right. Yeah. Let me get dressed to go out.
Into the water?
Yeah.
Right. Well.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, Greg, I'll speak to the Hoaxacost event, but since we got on this, and I had notes prepared on this subject, in 1939, Professor Carlton Coon, C-O-O-N, of Harvard University wrote a book called The Races of Europe. It runs to over 700 pages and is filled with pictures, charts, maps, diagrams, and scholarly footnotes. I have to get myself a copy of this. In this book, Professor Coon made a startling statement, quote, Queen Hetep Harrah II of the Fourth Dynasty, the daughter of Cheops, the builder of the Great Pyramid, in my opinion, he was just the remodeler of the Great Pyramid, is shown in the colored bas-reliefs of her tomb to have been a distinct blonde. Her hair is painted a bright yellow, stippled with red horizontal lines. It's in fashion again today, folks. And her skin is white.
Blonde hair is prevalent amongst the mummies of ancient Egypt.
Right.
From before the 18th dynasty, 19th dynasty.
Yes, yes. And he says, this is the earliest known evidence of blondism in the world. It unfortunately doesn't give a date as to, you know, how – well, it says 4th dynasty, whatever that is. Okay.
Oh, the 4th dynasty. Yeah, that's like 2800 B.C.
Okay. And obviously there's got to be more evidence. I think the I don't know how old this article is, but certainly the mummies they found in China in I forget the province, but it's the most southwesterly province of the Tarim Basin. They found clearly evidence of white mummies.
Right,
and
but they aren't anywhere near as old.
They're probably
date to the Scythian period. I sincerely believe those people are
probably Scythians.
The Scythians of and who later became Tocharians.
Right,
and
right.
It's established that the Tocharian language is wholly similar to the Celtic. So.
Okay, Tocharian. Yes, exactly. Okay, now where could the Egyptian blondes have come from? There are a number of possibilities. Libyans, megalith builders, Sumerians, and people from the Caucasus Mountain, Ukraine area. How about that, folks?
How about Mizraim?
Okay. Yes,
how about Mizraim and the descendants of Noah?
Yeah, right, Hamites. How about Hamites? Exactly. The ancient Libyans extended from the Canary Islands across North Africa to the Delta of the Nile. Okay, yeah, that whole northern coast of Africa is what they're talking about. Plus the Canary Islands, and that's exactly the area we understand as having been populated by the Hamites, okay? The western third of the Nile Delta was occupied by Libyans during the early years of recorded civilization. Is it possible that a white Caucasian people may have composed the bulk of the ruling class in ancient Egypt? Well, of course. Well, that's our whole point. Now the word they're using here is Libyans. What do you make of the word Libyan? Because it's not connected with the word lewd and any other of the nations of Genesis 10.
No, it's not. But in the prophets, and I believe it's in Ezekiel, and I'm going to look it up right now. But he mentions a people called the Lubim.
Okay.
L-U-B-I-M.
Right.
And here it is in Nahum. I'm sorry, Nahum 3:9. Now Nahum's one of the later prophets.
Yes.
And he, I mean, there may be a Greek influence here on his writing. I don't know. I would have to examine the book, and I really don't study Hebrew. So.
Yeah.
In Nahum 3:9, Ethiopia and Egypt were her strength, and
yes.
It was infinite. Put and Lubim were thy helpers. And
okay.
That L-U-B.
Right.
And Lubim, in Hebrew, it's L. Strong's has L-U-W-B-I-Y.
Wow. Okay.
And that's
there you go.
And they don't go back to Genesis 10.
Okay.
And the origin of the name to me is obscure.
Yes.
But Lubi is a Hebrew word, and it may have been a Hebrew word that I can conjecture that the Israelite Phoenicians put on the pre-Phoenician natives of northern Africa.
Okay.
And I can't prove that, but
right.
That seems to make sense to me, and that's why we have the word from Hebrew.
Right.
And
as is so often the case with Hebrew names, they are surnamed by Yahweh. Okay. Lubia. There you go. Libya. Okay.
The Lubim, the I.M. is the patronymic. In other words, if you had children,
mm-hmm.
they would be called the Elim,
right.
the Eli, and
exactly.
that I.M. would be stuck on the end. You
right.
know what I
mean? Exactly, meaning plural descendants of, yes.
Right.
Okay.
And it's Lubi is the form of the
yeah.
word, and it's definitely Libya. There's
yeah.
no doubt.
Yeah, and
that's not the origin of the word. And
yeah.
we see it in AM 39, and that's at least the 5th century B.C., and,
mm-hmm.
and maybe a little before that.
Let me continue here, because this really backs up what we were saying in some of the earlier segments of this series, in this two seed line series. Who were the Libyans and where'd they come from? Professor Kuhn tells us that during the Upper Paleolithic era, 30,000 to 5,000 BC, Europe and Northwest Africa were occupied by a people called the Cro-Magnons. These were perhaps the most physically advanced and handsome race the world has ever seen. Their skulls were larger and farther evolved from the apes than those of any modern race of men. In view of the fact that the modern distribution of Cro-Magnon features is most frequent in the same areas where red hair is most common, it is probable that many Cro-Magnons had red hair. They were white people. And,
I'm going to, you know, Carlton Kuhn, you have to be a little careful, because he is coming from the viewpoints of, you know, the humanist
sure.
evolutionary viewpoint, which was prevalent at Harvard by the end of the 1800s.
Right, yeah. I'm not sure if this guy is an evolutionist. There hasn't been any hint of that in this article so far. He may have been a holdover from the Professor Carroll days, you know, who was clearly a two-seed liner, didn't know it. Okay. Today, Cro-Magnon features are most frequently found in Norway, Ireland, and the Rif of Morocco. The last-named region is occupied by the descendants of the ancient Libyans. Kuhn tells us that in prehistoric times, a group of Cro-Magnons called the Afalu occupied North Africa, and that the Libyans were descended from them. The modern Berbers are the remnants of the ancient Libyans. Kuhn tells us that many ancient Cro-Magnon skulls of Denmark and Sweden are identical to the skulls from Afalu Bo Rumel. In Algeria, Braidwood says, excuse me, Cro-Magnon people were tall and big-boned with large, long, and rugged heads. They must have been built like many present-day Scandinavians. Okay, so direct connection between Cro-Magnon and modern Aryan man, folks. And this ties together the fact that Berber, the language called Berber, is understood by the Welsh and by Gaelic Celts, because Welsh is virtually identical with Hebrew. And as we trace the language distribution, the Hamito-Semitic languages, which today are called Celtic and Welsh, come from Egypt. It's the Hamitic speech and the Shemitic speech combined. Okay, ancient Egyptian paintings of Libyans depicted them as white, with blonde hair, blue eyes, and Nordic facial features.
Well, I was just going to say that I could cite Aeschylus, who was a 5th century Greek poet.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the tragic poets. And he clearly states that the women of Libya and Carthage are homogenous with Greek and Roman, Greek and Italian, you know, Sicilian women.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah.
He gives
a
list of women from all over the Mediterranean, and he definitely intones that they all basically look alike.
Right, yeah, they're all white.
Yes.
Greek society and, of course, Hamito-Semitic society was white.
Well, right,
simple.
And Diodorus Siculus wrote about Libyans that lived along the coast that were friendly to the Phoenicians and allies of them.
Mm-hmm.
And he also wrote about Libyans of the deep interior who were nomadic and more
right.
savage in nature.
Yes, yes. Okay. Yeah, okay. Sir Flinders Petrie, known as the father of Egyptology, had this to say, quote, the physiognomy gives a decisive pronounced connection between prehistoric Egypt and ancient Libya, and thus anthropology supports the many evidences which archaeology has given for a close connection between Egypt and Libya, and of course the European Nordics is what he's getting at here. And so we have all of these archaeologists who are basically agreeing with our analysis, and we talked about this at length last time, about the Hamites, Shemites, and Japhethites filling in the Mediterranean basin providing nations such as Greece, Rome, Lydia, now Libya, Egypt, Ethiopia, the two Ethiopias, and various civilizations filling in the Mediterranean basin and spreading primarily north and west.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The progression of the white race started in Mesopotamia and worked its way around the Mediterranean up into Britain, and we filled in the interior of Europe later.
Mm-hmm. Question, who were the megalith builders? They were people with a unified culture who loved sailing the sea and founding new colonies of megalith builders. Megaliths are found in Sweden, Denmark, Ireland, Brittany, Spain, the Balearic Islands, Corsica, Sardinia, Sicily, and North Africa. In other words, they are found all along the Atlantic coast and the Mediterranean. Von Lichtenberg found a megalith at Edfu in Egypt. Cromlechs and dolmens, two types of megaliths, were built at Mahadi near Cairo. And, of course, the cromlechs and dolmens, you'll find those in Ireland and Britain, okay?
Well, there's something else, and Frederick Haberman, I believe, wrote about it. And that was, an amazing number of stone circles were found early on in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
Of ancient stone circles.
Yes, yes.
And that's, it's a lot of that archaeology is suppressed. A great amount of the pre-Israeli archaeology of Palestine is suppressed.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Even when it's not suppressed, we get it from the Jewish viewpoint.
Exactly, exactly. They're the ones that mix up the categories for us. Yeah. Okay, so I just wanted to stress that our depiction of the spreading out of the nations of Genesis chapter 10 is verified by all kinds of archaeology. It's certainly biblical. It's certainly scriptural. And once you understand who these nations are and the fact that they're all of white origin, they're not Chinese, they're not black, they're not Mayan, they're not Eskimo. They are of white origin, as we would expect Ham, Shem, and Japheth, the sons of Noah, to be white and not three different races, as is so commonly preached from the Baal pulpits of the Judeo-Christian world. Folks, that's absolute nonsense. Absolute nonsense. And there's no scientist who agrees with that, although they will teach a different form of evolution.
there were actually German ethnographers in the 1930s who were writing books about White Africa, about white Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And that information was with the rest of German scholarship, was drummed out of existence after World War II.
Right, exactly, exactly.
And I was wrong about Nahum. I have to apologize. He was actually in the 7th century B.C. group of prophets who wrote before the fall of Nineveh.
Okay, okay.
I was putting him with Malachi and Zechariah and those who wrote a little
mm-hmm.
later.
So he was around the time of, it would be Jonah, right?
Jonah mm-hmm. and probably not too long after Isaiah and before Jeremiah and Ezekiel.
Right, okay. And so quickly, I'll just, I mentioned the event I went to with the White Nationalists of Illinois. That was very good. That was excellent. I was able to speak with a lot of people who had never heard of identity before. And we're just pleased that there is a Christianity that's for white people. Just about everybody assumes that Christianity is Jewish. And I told them, absolutely not. This book, this Bible I'm holding in my hand, is not a Jewish book. Jesus is not a Jew. The Jews are not Israel. And, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so there were a few skeptics in the audience, but I think by the end of my talk, I pretty much had them convinced.
Well, for many years, I dealt with guys that were Asatru, Odinists, pagans, and they could never, and when I laid out the correlations between the Aryan religions of, the Voluspa, the Nibelungen Lied, Snorri's Eddas, and
mm-hmm.
all those, and I've read a great deal of that literature, and you could actually draw many correlations to the Hebrew Old Testament, and the beliefs are basically, they boil down to being the same thing.
Yeah.
And I would expect that from my viewpoint,
mm-hmm.
and if I found anything different from that, I might be worried. However, it's very clear that all of that correlates to the Old Testament, and all of the people that I ever debated with over those things who were pagans,
mm-hmm.
none of them could ever approach me on either the religious grounds or the historical.
Yeah, of course not.
But they reject a regulation of their own morality, and I found that that was always at the core
right.
of why they rejected Christianity.
Well, yeah, they want to do their mess.
Yeah, they want to do their mess. They want to screw around.
Yeah.
They want to have promiscuous sex, and,
right.
and they don't believe that they should be restricted from that.
Exactly, exactly. And so what I'm getting from my prison ministry is that more and more white men in prison are rejecting that lifestyle. They see that it's self-destructive and destructive of the white race, and so they're abandoning it. And I think Christian identity is definitely filling the breach.
Right. Well, I did my share. I had two wives and six kids and
oh,
a
right.
girlfriend and all.
I didn't know you were a meth addict.
The same way, but
yeah.
it takes a prison spell to wake a guy out of that sometimes.
Yeah. Before I talk about the Holocaust inauguration and the demonstration, there's a question from Fausto. I have read Carlton Kuhn's The Races of Europe, and it slightly depresses me, in particular what it says about the Neanderthals. Well, in my opinion, the Neanderthals are not white. In my opinion, they're descendants of the fallen angels, and most of them were wiped out. Okay.
I can't be entirely sure about the Cro-Magnon connection, and I'm not sure I accept that.
Okay.
The Cro-Magnons, from what I understand, had smaller brain capacities than we do.
No, they had larger brain capacities.
Well, I was under the understanding that the Neanderthals had larger brain capacities.
Yeah, but they had receding foreheads, and they had the thick foreheads with the heavy eyebrows.
Oh,
they,
okay.
Maybe you got the two confused.
I may have the two confused.
Right, the Cro-Magnon are clearly white. Yeah, and the Neanderthals are the ape-like looking ones. Okay, they look more like apes. And those died out. And my understanding is that they were strictly meat eaters. They ate no kind of vegetable food at all. And as a result, they were eating up the food of the normal people. Well, let's call them Cro-Magnons and other races. And as a result, there was a conflict between normal-sized human beings and these Neanderthals, who were much much more primitive and less intelligent. And so the Cro-Magnons basically wiped them out. And that's how I understand it happened. So the Neanderthals were definitely not white. You would hesitate to classify them even as human. You know, however you want to classify human, how many different subspecies of featherless bipeds you want to include in the word human, they were definitely not human. Okay.
Well, I think that we'd have to postulate that if the Cro-Magnon were white and they lived 40,000 years ago,
yeah.
and there's solid evidence of that they're probably the fallen angels.
Okay.
Mixed
well,
with the Neanderthals and the other races.
Okay. Yeah. Well, either way is possible. But I don't think that the white race are to be connected with the fallen angels. In my opinion, they're the survivors of Atlantis. Okay. And they had a worldwide civilization to which the fallen angels descended. That's how I see it. Okay.
I don't know if I want to call that Atlantis or give credence to Plato, because even the ancient Greeks didn't give credence to Plato.
Yeah, well, there's a lot of latest research shows that there was definitely an island type civilization out in the Atlantic, and it sunk considerably, almost 2 miles deep. And they found cities down there. Okay, and then the climate of the planet was definitely different in 10,500 BC when all this happened. Okay, and I'm trying to think Atlantis. I'm trying to think of the, anyways, Otto Muck. If you can get a hold of the book by Otto Muck, M-U-C-K, he wrote the archaeological and geological evidence for the existence of Atlantis. It's very, very compelling, and for me it was convincing, and that he dates it to 10,500 B.C., okay, a worldwide catastrophe that created a melting of the ice age, you know, of the tremendous ice age that had covered the northern hemisphere.
I don't doubt that there may have been civilizations there, and I don't doubt that this planet hasn't had a very long history before the advent of our race on it,
mm-hmm.
approximately 7,500 years ago.
Yeah, okay.
However, there's 4,000 years of inscriptions and 500 years of Greek writing and 1,000 years of Hebrew writing before Plato.
Mm-hmm.
And he's
mm-hmm.
the first one to call this Atlantis.
Right.
And that's... The Greeks had a very skeptical view towards that. Strabo
oh, sure.
does, and several other Greek writers did.
Sure, sure. Yeah, and so has most of humanity ever since that. Okay.
Well, I mean, of Plato's account in particular.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that the civilization didn't exist. Surely it did, and the Bible surely infers that.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
However, I don't know if Plato's version of it is to be believed. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, I wrote this up in Enmity parts 2 and 3 on my website, anglo-saxonisrael.com. It's in the archives, so anybody wants to look that up. Pretty much give most of the evidence for the existence of Atlantis and the fact that it was run by white people, okay? And so and that's why I include them in the Cro-Magnon, okay? But in any case, be that as it may, the event last Sunday, the Holocaust Museum dedication, I was hoping to get there to see Bill Clinton, but I got it there at the very beginning, and one of the speakers was talking about the Nazi demonstration in Skokie 32 years ago and how that, quote-unquote, galvanized the Jewish community of Skokie. What the speaker failed to mention, though, was that Frank Collin, who was the organizer of that Nazi demonstration, was himself a Jew, posing as a Nazi and using Jewish money to create a Nazi cell in Skokie, where there probably would not have been one without the Jewish money that he had, okay? That same guy, Frank Collin, is now a pornographer in the state of Wisconsin. And, of course, that speaker did not mention any details about Frank Collin being the true organizer of that Nazi demonstration 32 years ago, okay? So while I was there listening to that more Jewish disinformation, I turned around and looked at the sea of probably the ugliest faces, collection of ugliest faces I've seen in a long time. Basically Jews, the hook-nosed schnozzes were everywhere, the distorted faces and the receding foreheads, you name it, the typical Jewish countenance, the Barbra Streisand type countenance, and that's as pretty as they get, folks. That's as pretty as they get. And a smattering of liberals and, blacks and mixed-race people, all kinds of mongrelized people there. I couldn't stand being around those people, so I left and I tried to meet up with the demonstrators who were at the corner of Harms and Golf. I was only half a block away, but there was so much security that the first police officer stopped me and prevented me from walking at half a block, from the entrance to the Holocaust Museum to the demonstration. So I had to get back on a shuttle bus, drive the 2 miles back to my parking lot, and get into my car. And I drove as close as I could to the demonstrators, and then I walked the rest of the way. And it varied from the time I was there. Yeah, I was grossed out, Greg. I linked up. They were primarily NSM people. And so they had their Hitler signs and flags and stuff, and then, there was probably 15, 20 of them there, and sometimes it maybe went up to 30, depending, because people came and left. And then finally, the white nationalists from Illinois joined up with us, and then we had a really good crowd, and we were chanting with a megaphone, and things like 1, 2, 3, 4, we don't want your Jewish war, 2, 4, 6, 8, we don't want your Jewish hate, as loud as we could. And then it got fairly interesting because around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, this whole time was raining. It was raining pretty steadily this whole time, so the flags were getting all wet and they wouldn't blow in the wind. But when the event started to end, busloads of Jews were being ferried right in front of us, okay? And all the Nazis were, as loud as they could, were chanting, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil, Sieg Heil. And you should have seen the faces of the old Jewish ladies contorting in a sheer agony and torture. You can see the visions of the ovens, that never happened, of course, and being terrorized by these demonstrators. So that part was pretty funny. I had a really good time, watching the interplay between the Nazis on the corner and the old Jews in the buses, so that was pretty funny. But outside of that, it was rather uneventful. I usually expect trouble, some sort of trouble, but nothing like that happened, probably because of the rain. It was just too rainy for anything like that to happen. And pretty much they stayed on their side of the tape, and we stayed on our side of the tape, and that's pretty much the end of it. We just had a couple of maybe cars stop and honk their horns and make nasty gestures at us. And then there were a few white power cars that drove by too. It was probably maybe 4-1 in favor of the pro-Jewish people. And but outside of that, it wasn't too eventful. It was fun though. I was really glad I attended all that. And I was ready to go to jail. had there been, you know, violence, there often is in these demonstrations, okay? So that's pretty much what happened last Saturday and Sunday, and that's why I was absent. And I'm thanking Bill for filling in for me. I listened to part of the show you did with Clifton Emenheiser, and then the show you and Greg and Gary did on Sunday. That was pretty good.
Yeah, it was Greg that filled in for you. I just worked the board.
Yeah, yeah. So it's good you can do that. And, you may have to, on May 9th, I'm going to be out of town, so I may ask you to fill in for me again that weekend.
And, yeah, I could plan something.
Yes, okay. And now, just one more quick announcement before we get into, the planned program here. And that is, apparently there's an outbreak of swine flu in Mexico. Now, swine flu is a hoax, folks. It's nothing but Jewish slop being injected into the veins and arteries of innocent people, and it's part of the International New World Order depopulation program. That's what all of these vaccination programs are. They're created to make you sick and make you pay for the disease, whether in money or in death, okay? Do not, absolutely under no circumstances, do not accept a swine flu injection. It will make you sick and will probably kill you. If you're lucky, it'll just make you very sick. Stay away from all vaccinations of every kind. They cause autism. They cause, lung disease?
Tuberculosis.
Well, yeah, that too, but the ones that have difficulty breathing, it's fairly common now.
Asthma,
exactly.
Asthma is very common now. It's incredible. Our people should stay away from all of that anyway.
Yes.
And I don't like to... I haven't taken a pill, I think, since 1998.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And that's the right way to be. You know,
right.
Stay away from all that stuff. It's all, I think Gary mentioned, Monsanto and Kane are in the same business, hybridization and making us sick. They're in the
Absolutely.
Same business. Yes. Okay. All right. So we left off in Chapter 10. I think we briefly ventured into Chapter 11. Verses 6 and 7, because in my Bible here, they're highlighted in red. And let me just really go back to that. Behold, the people is one, and they have all one language, and this they began to do, and now nothing will be restrained from them, which they have imagined to do. Go to, let us go down, and there confound their language, and they may not understand one another's speech. So that's the Tower of Babel scenario, okay? Now we're after the Tower of Babel scenario.
Let me remark first on this tower. The ancient Sumerian peoples are well known for the building of ziggurats.
Yes.
And here the tower, it might be a symbol. However, in the Ubaid period, which is the period from about 5300 to 4000 BC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there weren't the children of Adam were wiped out in the flood in 3245 BC.
Mm-hmm.
So this may well be intoning the pre-Adamic peoples and the children of Cain, the Kenites and whoever Cain had married and taken a wife from and built a city for.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of evidence that the Kenites are in Babylonia at this time.
Right, right.
And they were well known for building these ziggurats,
mm-hmm.
which are these conical stared towers that and
right.
This very well may be, this indicates to me that the children of Noah had adopted that practice.
Yes, certainly.
In other words, they
under
were
Nimrod, yes.
integrated and polluted with paganism again at this time. And,
yes.
and we're, you know, the Bible doesn't spend a whole lot of time in that period between the flood in Genesis 9 and the time of Abraham.
Mm-hmm.
We only have two chapters, 10 and 11.
Right, right, yeah, and it's very sparse, and we pretty much have to fill in the blanks historically, you know.
Right, and what people have to realize is that there are over 1,200 years between the time that Shem is born and the call of Abraham.
Right.
Or I'm sorry, between the time that Arphaxad is born.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the Shem's son Arphaxad said, and the call of Abraham. It's over 1,200 years.
Right.
The
yeah.
flood and the call of Abraham.
So say roughly 1,500 years between the end of the flood and Abraham. Something like that.
About 1,300. Yes.
1,300. Okay. All right. So let's go into chapter 12 because we want to establish here, folks, that we're talking seed line. Okay. Getting back to the main thrust of this entire series, which is two seed line. Verse 1. Now Yahweh had said to Abram, get you out of your country and from your kindred and from your father's house to a land that I will show you. Any comments on Abraham's house, the people of his house?
Well, there was nothing wrong with the people of his house in particular,
mm-hmm.
but for some reason, Yahweh did not want Abraham there.
Yes.
And this is about the time we have the rise of the Mitanni kingdom.
Okay.
Which they're actually Horites, Hurrians, that had come to rule over this area in Mesopotamia.
Okay.
And they're related to the Hittites. And,
yes,
and,
absolutely, yes.
But on the other hand, Abraham was able to send back to his kindred.
Yes.
And later on for wives, for Isaac, and then much later on for Jacob.
Right, exactly. And so these were the Arphaxad and Haran. Which tribe? Which
this
nation?
This is Arphaxad. It's the land of Arphaxad, and it's in Paddan Aram, which is what we know today is the far northern part of Syria.
Okay.
Along the Armenian border.
Okay. So roughly Armenia, and this was peopled by whites, kindred of Abraham at that time. Arphaxad, and who was Arphaxad's brother?
Aram was one
Aram.
Of the,
Aram,
the
exactly.
father of the Syrians, whose land was to the south, in yeah. between Paddan Aram and Canaan.
Yeah, and so we had Elam, which is the Persians. We had Arphaxad and Aram and Lud, the Lydians and the Syrians. Okay, all these people are, in fact, the descendants of Shem. So when Abraham sent for wives, for a wife for his son Isaac, he sent back to Paddan Aram, which was where these people lived, okay, his white kindred. Okay, verse 2. And I will make of you a great nation, and I will bless you and make your name great, and you shall be a blessing. Of course, now that we're getting close to the one that the Jews love to quote. This one here, folks, is unconditional. This simply says, you shall be a blessing. There is no conditional such, which is, if people bless you, you will be blessed. If people curse you, you will be cursed. Verse 3, and I will bless them that bless you and curse them that curses you, and in you shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So two questions for you, Bill, real quick. Have the Jews been a blessing because they claim to be of Abraham? And has America been blessed or cursed by blessing the Israelis?
If you want to count the loss of all of our corporate property and compound interest as blessings, then surely we've been blessed. An
yeah.
ever-inflating dollar.
Right.
You know, they've been nothing but a curse in reality.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews have been nothing but a curse, and they're not the descendants of Abraham who were counted for the seed.
Right.
Who were counted for the promise. They're playing that role. But that's not them. They're clearly the Edomites and Canaanites of the Old Testament.
Mm-hmm.
They are the cursed people, and they have been a curse.
That's right.
And just very history to me proves two seed line over and over again.
All right.
In any century that I look at.
Yeah. As long yeah.
that you read about.
As long as you know the difference between the Israelites and the Canaanites slash Jews. Okay. If you assume that the Shemites are the Jews, then you're all confused.
But then the Jews haven't filled any of these prophecies.
That's right.
As we progress through Genesis here, these next few chapters, there are many promises to Abraham, and they've all been fulfilled, but none of them have been fulfilled in the Jews.
That's right. Absolutely right. Okay.
Now,
so
I have to make a remark.
Okay.
And that is that in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed.
Yes.
And this is in the context of those Genesis 10
right.
families.
Yes.
And it basically means, and you shall all the white families of the earth be blessed.
Mm-hmm.
That it's only talking about the children of Adam.
Right.
And that's the only context that the Bible supplies for us in listing all the families of the earth are, mm-hmm. are those families listed in Genesis chapter 10.
Yes. Okay. I have a reference here back to Galatians 3:8, which might verify that. I don't know if you got a chance to flip back to Galatians 3:8, but I'll continue reading here. So Abram departed as Yahweh had spoken to him, and Lot went with him. And Abram was 75 years old when he departed out of Haran. And Abram took Sarai his wife, and Lot his brother's son, and all their substance that they had gathered, and the souls they had gotten to in Haran, and they went forth to go into the land of Canaan, and into the land of Canaan they came. Now, in my opinion, what's going on here is that the fallen angel people, who were both pre-flood and post-flood, because the Bible clearly says that some of them survived the flood, and since the flood was primarily local in wherever Noah and his family was, the deluge was global, but the flood, the upwelling of aquifer water that filled up the bowl, that increased the level of the waters more than the rain did, and that's what caused the ark to float. Throughout the whole planet, we have all kinds of legends of people who survived the flood, and in fact, in China, they tell us that the flood nearly approached the mouth or the beginning of the Yellow River, which was way up in the north of the Tarim Basin, okay? So none of our people were up there. The Chinese clearly record that that's how far the floodwaters rose in the Tarim Basin, okay? So in my opinion, obviously Yahweh had plans for the Israelites to take over Canaan land. But I think the fallen angel people and these Kenites and Canaanites probably anticipating that, you know, and they settled in the land of milk and honey before the Israelites could.
Okay. Well, I don't think that Yahweh's plans could fail.
Right, of course not.
I think that perhaps when the land was divided,
mm-hmm.
that the Canaanites and the Rephaim and those people had taken that land, knowing that that land was for the sons of Shem, and knowing that Shem, being the oldest of the three, would be the heir.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That he would receive the choicest portion of land, and they attempted to deprive him of that.
Yes, yes.
And that's something that's not really written in Scripture, but it is alluded to in the book of Jasher and in other books.
Right, right, yeah. Love that Leah says, hey, Patricia is trying to get in, but the library has denied access to your show. Of course, they don't believe in freedom of speech, do they? Racists don't have the right of freedom of speech. Well, this is too bad, Leah. The day's coming when the Jews are going to deny you the right to freedom of speech. You just don't know it yet. But that day is certainly coming.
Well, I had the same problem with the Binghamton Public Library here in New York. Before I came upstate, I had to go to a library to get on the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And I had the same, I couldn't get into your website.
Right, right, yeah. Because the Jews control freedom of speech. And that is, they deny freedom of speech to those of us who have a differing point of view. There's nowhere in the Bible that says you should have the right to deny other people their perspective or their point of view. So you can call us what you want to call us. We're not preventing people from their freedom of speech.
Actually, it's quite the opposite.
Yes.
And I have on the front page of my own website, the prophet Isaiah's warning to the politically correct thought police.
Mm-hmm.
For the terrible one is brought to naught, and the scorner is consumed.
Yes.
And all that watch for iniquity are cut off,
mm-hmm.
that make a man an offender for a word,
yes.
and that lay a snare
racist
for him
is the
that
word.
Reproves in the gate.
Yes, yeah, they're going to get
turn
their...
aside the just for a thing of naught.
So love that, Leah. I suggest you listen closely, because you're on the wrong side. You're not on God's side. Anybody who calls us racists is, in fact, a Canaanite. And these Canaanites, as you very well know, rule the world, and they're trying to prevent us from speaking. Let's go to Genesis 12:7. And Yahweh appeared to Abraham and said, to your seed will I give this land, which means, of course, offspring.
Well, that makes Yahweh a racist.
Yes. How about that? He didn't give it to the whole world. He just gave it to Israel, or these predecessors of the Israelites anyway. And he moved from there to a mountain on the east of Bethel, and pitched his tent, having Bethel on the west and Haon on the east. And there he built an altar to Yahweh and called upon the name of Yahweh. Any comment up to this point here?
No further comments on this, these promises in 12.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So when all of this is getting ready to set up the the days of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob before the Egyptian captivity. Let me just jump over to chapter 13 where these promises are repeated. 13:14, and Yahweh said to Abraham, after that Lot was separated from him, lift up now your eyes and look from the place where you are northward and southward and eastward and westward, for all the land which you see to you will I give it and to your seed forever. Okay, now verse 15, it says your offspring, and here in this King James Version, it has in parentheses descendants, okay, forever. Now, either God is a liar or spiritual Israel has taken the place of these descendants.
Right, and that's not possible because spiritual Israel can't be his seed.
That's right.
And the word is zerah, and it's the common word for seed, and in males, it can only be sperm.
Yes.
Which is the way the same word is translated into Greek,
mm-hmm.
sperma.
Yes, sperma.
And we're going to see that reinforced here in chapters 15 and 17, I believe.
Yes. Okay. So verse 16, and I will make your seed, that is descendants, as the dust of the earth, so that if a man can number the dust of the earth, then shall your seed also be numbered. And here we, this emphasis on the word seed is very strong here in chapter 13. And
right.
In every case, it means descendants.
And the church teaches that the dust of the earth became his seed. And that's not true. And
right.
The Bible's saying that his seed would become numbered as the dust of the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And the church has actually changed the prophecy in the words of Yahweh and turned them around.
Right.
And
right.
made a lie out of them.
Exactly, exactly. And then he says, arise, walk through the land and the length of it and the breadth of it, for I will give it to you. And, of course, this means the descendants of Abraham through Isaac and Jacob would be so large that they wouldn't be able to count it. Now, that's not true of the Jewish people. The Jewish people have always been a minority in every nation, whichever they have lived, and usually it has been the descendants of Abraham who created these nations, and the Jews, the minority, walked into them with their parasitic banking practices.
And perverted
morality and theft and murder, et cetera, parasitizing off of the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Isn't that true history?
Absolutely. If the Jews were really the heirs to Abraham,
heirs, yes.
and the seed of Abraham, then they would be establishing wonderful
civilized
right. nations.
They haven't. They've never established anything. Never. They've always destroyed nations, whatever nation they have come into. They have been a curse, and they haven't been farmers, which is the curse of Cain, okay? The land will not yield for a Jew, because a Jew is a descendant of Cain. He's not a descendant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, okay? All right, let's jump to verse chapter 15. After these things, the word of Yahweh came to Abraham in a vision, saying, fear not, Abraham, I am your shield, and your exceeding great reward, okay? He's referring to himself, Yahweh's referring to himself, and the seed of Abraham as his people, okay? No one else counts. Is there any indication here that anybody else except the seed of Abraham will be God's chosen people?
Right, and this is other Adamic white people being set aside in favor of Abraham.
Right.
And there's nothing basically wrong with those people.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing wrong with Lot at this time.
I mean,
before his daughters have incest with him.
Right.
But at this time, Lot is he's separated from Abraham.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. Jumping to verse 13, and he said to Abraham, know of a surety that your seed, again, the emphasis on seed, descendants, offspring, shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Of course, this is talking about the Egyptian captivity. Verse 14, and also that nation whom they shall serve will I judge, and afterward shall they come out with great substance, and you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation there shall come here again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full. Now, here we have a clear distinction between, we know that the descendants of Abraham that were in Egyptian captivity were the Israelites, and these Amorites are being contrasted with the Israelites. Isn't that correct?
Right. That's exactly, and the Amorites are actually descendants of the Canaanites.
Right. Exactly.
The, there's something in chapter 15, though, that we really have to discuss.
Okay.
And that's the Abraham attempts to select Eleazar of Damascus as his heir.
Okay, as his heir. The H is silent.
I'm trying to properly enunciate it.
Yes.
And behold, the word of the Lord came unto him, saying, this shall not be thine heir,
mm-hmm.
but he that shall come forth from out of thy bowels shall be thine heir.
Okay, right.
In other words, Yahweh wouldn't allow Abraham a substitution.
Mm-hmm.
And today
right.
the church is trying to claim that there is a substitution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
the church itself is a substitute.
Yes, and that's an amazing lie. That's a bold, bold lie.
Well, see, the Old Testament is obsolete. They're New Testament Christians.
Right, that's just crazy. And I'm only trying to point out the hypocrisy of that.
That's right.
Abraham, Eleazar of Damascus was almost certainly of Aram.
Mm-hmm.
Damascus was the principal city of the Arameans, the descendants of Aram, who was Arphaxad's brother.
Mm-hmm.
He was definitely an Adamic Shemite, and yet he wasn't good enough. Abraham's heir had
right.
to come from his bowels,
right.
from his seed.
Exactly, exactly. And obviously Yahweh had Isaac in mind all along to be the progenitor of the Israelite Anglo-Saxon people, okay? All right, any more comments up to verse 16 in chapter 15?
No.
Okay, because here's where it starts getting good, because we're getting ready to name the non-Israelite peoples that occupied the land that Yahweh promised to Abraham. So verse 17. And it came to pass that when the sun went down, it was dark. Behold, a smoking furnace and a burning lamp that passed between those pieces. Well, what's this a reference to? Any? It sounds like it may be a prophecy or a reference to the oath that was commonplace in those days. Did Eleazar have anything to do with that? The blood oath that they had to pass between the two halves of a sacrificed animal.
Oh no, that was only between Yahweh and Abraham.
Right.
That's definitely that. Abraham did not pass through the two parts of the animal.
Okay.
And that's an important thing that most people miss when discussing the Abrahamic covenant.
Okay.
Abraham has no liability.
Ah. Okay.
Yahweh will fulfill the covenant, or Yahweh is liable to die, as the animal did.
Mm-hmm.
Now that is the reason for that covenant.
Yes.
In other words, when we make a contract and we split the animal in half, we both pass through it, and that's to profess that the man that breaks the contract, it should be to him as it is to that animal.
Right.
Well, Yahweh didn't force Abraham or impel Abraham to pass through the pieces of the animal.
Mm-hmm.
Only Yahweh is liable if the covenant fails.
Yes, yes.
And that covenant's to Abraham's seed.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, so I skipped over verses 9 through 10, which discuss this, and this verse 17 is a reference back to that, okay, because I was stressing Abraham's seed. But what you just spoke to proves that this covenant was made only with Abraham's seed.
And Abraham and his seed cannot fail because they weren't compelled to pass through the pieces of the animal.
This is Yahweh's promise to his seed.
That's why it's unconditional.
It's unconditional, absolutely.
And that's because nothing's expected of Abraham.
That's right, except to produce offspring.
Right.
Right, okay. So verse 18, in the same day Yahweh made a covenant with Abraham, his name hasn't been changed yet, saying, to your seed. Now, how many times has this said, to your seed? Not to your spiritual seed, but to your literal offspring have I given this land from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. Now, these are the nations, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, and the Rephaims, which are fallen angel people, folks, and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites and the Jebusites. These are the 10 nations of the Kenites, folks. These are not Israelites. These are later will be referred to as the Canaanite people. So let's go through these different nations one at a time. These are the 10 nations, contrasting the 10 nations of Ham, Shem, and Japheth. I'm sorry, the nations of Genesis chapter 10, okay, versus these 10 nations in Genesis 15, 19 through 21, who are a non-Adamic people, the Kenites. What do you have to say about the Kenites?
Well, they're the descendants of Cain.
Yes, absolutely. And the fact is, the Jews have a tradition of naming themselves after their father, Cain. Cain is a very common Jewish surname, okay? A variation of Cain is Kagan, Kaganovich, Kazan.
Right, that's from Khan also.
Yeah, Khan
and
itself.
That's because Cain is actually, if you look at the spellings in Strong's Concordance, first it's K-N.
Mm-hmm.
It has a Q-A-Y-I-N.
Right.
And it also that it's like an apostrophe type guttural sound,
mm-hmm.
and it was smoothed out by the Western.
Sure.
I have to say by the Western Semitic peoples who became Phoenicians and Greeks.
Yes.
And it was smoothed out and ultimately forgotten.
Yes.
But the Eastern peoples that the Assyrians had a very rough guttural sound, and that's why we have Cumri instead of Omri.
Mm-hmm.
And the people of the East, and as the Jews who adopted the Hebrew language moved east, and they maintain that rough guttural sound.
Right, yeah, in Yiddish. It's still alive in Yiddish today.
It sounds like they're coughing up hairballs, like a
right.
house cat when they're coughing.
Exactly.
When they're talking, it's crazy.
Yeah, it's not Hebrew.
No, my ancestors didn't speak anything like that.
Yeah, right, right. So we have all these Jewish surnames that relate to Cain. Ashkenaz would be another one, in my opinion, the Kenazites, okay, as one of the people here. And in addition, I know that, for example, in Genesis chapter 3, the serpent is identified as Nakash, okay, which means whisperer, deceiver, enchanter. And in the Chaldean, it means to shine like brass, which is a false shining. It's not the shining of true light, the light of truth that exists within the Adamites. Surnames such as Nachman, Nachberg, Nachstein, Nuchtern, Nachel. Some Russian Jews actually have the name Satanowski and Satansky. Okay. The fallen angel Ramiel has Ramelstein and the French Ramiel, Hamiel, and Hamel. The fallen angel Ariach, Ariachman, Rachman, Rachberg, Racco, and Raka, okay? The fallen angel Ariel Sharon, folks, does that ring a bell? Ariel Sharon, he's named after a fallen angel. Azazel, Zalman, Zelman, Azelman, Zazalski, Azalski, Kazalski, Balak, Balakman, and Morlach, which is a variation of Molech or Malach. Okay, so we have all these Jewish surnames which directly link themselves to these fallen angel people, to Cain himself, and it should be obvious. You know, why are they choosing surnames which reflect upon these 10 Canaanite nations and Cain himself? I mean, it should ring your suspicion, right?
Well, they know who their father is.
Yeah, they certainly do. They do. And since he was the great deceiver, and they follow in his footsteps, they have been able to deceive the whole world with the lie that they are Israel, when in fact they are Canaanites, Edomites, Khazars, etc. Okay. Now, this word Kenite, it definitely means, in Strong's Concordance, it tells us means descendants of Cain. Okay?
Yeah, that's the form of the word. That's unavoidable. They're
yes.
definitely the descendants of Cain.
Right. Now, it also has a reference in many of the concordances to mean metalsmith, okay? But wouldn't that be a reference back to Genesis chapter 4, where I forget which ones, the various, within the first seven generations of Cain, there were the first workers of metal and the first, and they produced the first implements of war out of metal. Wouldn't that be the association there, metalsmiths?
And that's what we're told of the so-called fallen angels in the Book of Enoch.
Okay.
And why wouldn't their descendants?
Right. Why wouldn't their descendants do the same thing?
Continue the tradition.
Exactly. They were the ones to make war first on this planet, and they've been making war, arranging wars for us Israelites ever since. Okay. What about the Kenizzites?
Kenizzites is only here in the Old Testament.
Okay.
It's nowhere else.
Okay.
Kadmonites is only here in the Old Testament.
Okay.
And these names, these three names, Kenites, Kenizzites, Kadmonites, by the time this same list is given later in Deuteronomy, these names disappear.
Right.
And it's actually, Moses here is writing about a period much earlier than the period of Deuteronomy, and it's very possible, and it's almost probable, because we have these people later, and the Kenites are the scribes in Chronicles, that they just lost their tribal identity through amalgamation with these other people.
Right, and in fact, the ten nations ultimately became seven nations, so these two tribes, the Kenizzites and Kadmonites, became amalgamated into those nations, and next is the Hittites.
There's one more thing I would like to say about the Kenizzites.
Okay.
A lot of Bible commentators, otherwise intelligent people, they like to connect the Kenizzites to Kenaz, the son of Esau.
Okay, I mentioned that as a surname.
Born until 300 years later, or whatever, 200 years later.
Yes.
And I mean, he's not listed until Genesis chapter 36 amongst the descendants of Esau.
Right.
And this is really dumb, because that asserts that Moses didn't know what he was talking about.
Right, yeah.
Okay?
Yeah, and it's,
Moses listing the Kenizzites in a context a couple of hundred years before Kenaz was born.
Right, although there may be a connection. It's possible that Kenaz...
Well, the connection could be just the meaning of the word.
Yeah.
The name Kenaz simply means hunter.
Okay.
And it's not necessarily connected to the Kenizzites.
Right, right.
And Esau was a hunter, and his sons would have been hunters.
Yeah.
I mean, that's only... Why not name one of your kids Hunter if you're a hunter?
And why, if you're Jewish, pick the word Kenaz as a surname, which obviously refers to Edomites, okay? So the connection, folks, is very dramatic that these Jews, even today, surname themselves after these ten nations of the Kenites, okay? So next is the Hittites. I'm sure we have a lot to say about the Hittites.
Well, the Hittites... They're a great empire by the time this is written, and it crumbled actually in 1500 BC, which is about 50 years before the Exodus. The Hittite Empire was in a serious downslide due to a wave of earthquakes and diseases in Anatolia, in the Hittite lands, and pockets of Hittites were scattered here and there by the time Moses actually recorded this.
Right.
The Hittites are derived from Heth.
Yes.
And they do, the Hittites and the Amorites and the Canaanites and the Girgashites, they're all mentioned in Genesis chapter 10 as descendants of Canaan.
Right.
However, I'm led to believe that because they don't all have actual patriarchs listed in Genesis 10, that they're really probably, except for the Hittites and the Canaanites of Sidon, the rest of them are probably just peoples that were aboriginal that the Hittites and the Canaanites mingled with.
Right. Now, the Rephaims are clearly fallen angel people.
This is the patronymic word from Rapha, which means giant.
Yes.
And we later on, and it's in Chronicles, we have Samson and his brothers, I'm sorry, Goliath and his brothers, are called the sons of Rapha, or the sons of the giant.
Right, right.
And some translations translate that, and some don't.
Yes.
And it's absolutely denotes that they are Rephaim.
Yes.
And we know from the story of David and Goliath that Goliath was a man of exceedingly great stature.
Yes.
And surely seemed like a Rephaim. He wasn't actually a Philistine. He was a Rephaim from the Valley of the Rephaim, found in later on in the books of Kings and Joshua, I think, in Judges, where the giants dwelt.
And he was a descendant of the tribe of Gath, G-A-T-H, And Gath was one of these Rephaim, and his bedstead in one of the books of the Old Testament is described as being roughly 22 feet long. Okay.
And the Philistines had actually made alliances with these people.
That's right. They made alliances with these giants who were actually survived the flood, folks, because the Bible says in Genesis chapter 6 there were giants before the flood and after the flood. Okay. And they weren't on board the ark.
And when I'm going to look for it. And when I come across it in my notes, I have actual newspaper articles of a strain, a genealogical strain of giants amongst the Jews of southern Russia and the Armenian mountain regions.
Interesting. Yeah, because these are definitely race-mixed people. And the fact that they were so race-mixed and they were race-mixed with the giants of Genesis chapter 6, with probably a lot of genetic experimentation going on. Because remember, when the Israelites came into the land of Canaan, the scouts looked at them and said, "We are grasshoppers in their sight. We are like grasshoppers in their sight." And they were afraid of these people.
And there, I have photos, actual photos. I have an article from the New York Times of a Jewish giant over 7 feet tall and his dwarfish, Jewish, typical 5 foot tall parents.
Right, exactly. Now, where'd that recessive gene come from?
Absolutely.
That's
and that's
right.
Absolutely what that is. It's a manifestation of the descendants of these Rephaim.
Yes, absolutely. And so we have the Amorites and, of course, the Canaanites. We discussed pretty much the Canaanites in great detail last time. And the Girgashites and the Jebusites. Any special indication on any of these other tribes here?
The Jebusites we find later in Jerusalem. David takes Jerusalem off of the Jebusites.
Right, right.
And the Girgashites and the Amorites, the Amorites are actually mentioned often later on in the New Testament. I'm sorry, in the Old Testament, in the conquest stories of the land of Canaan.
Yes.
And the Perizzites, the word Perizzite is obscure because it means villagers.
Okay.
And it might just mean these common... the common masses of people who were spread out throughout the villages of whatever race they are.
Yes.
And
yeah.
And often it could just be referred to that because the word appears
yeah.
a lot in the later books of Joshua, Judges, Kings,
right.
and Chronicles.
Yeah, so what's actually being portrayed here is kind of like if you ever saw that scene in one of the Star Trek movies where at the bar they have all kinds of weird creatures. Some humanoids that look like elephants, and humanoids that look like camels, and every
time. That's Jewish. That's the Jewish dream of
right.
That's
exactly.
The Jewish ideal of creation, anyway.
Yeah, that's why it's called Jews in Space.
Yeah.
The Jews themselves refer to it that. The Jewish writers who write all that crap, that's what they call it, Jews in Space. And so, yeah, this is exactly. It's kind of a sentimental look back. Star Wars is really a sentimental look back at Genesis 15, verses 19 through 21. That's what it is. And guess what, folks? The good guys came and were told by Yahweh to wipe them all out in the book of Deuteronomy. Why would Yahweh instruct our people to wipe out all these race-mixed, genetic experiment produced people? Why would Yahweh instruct the Israelites to wipe all these people out? Because they're contrary to his law. Race mixing is forbidden, folks. It's against the law of Yahweh. Deuteronomy 23:2, no mongrel shall enter the congregation of Yahweh. And if you don't believe that the priesthood of Israel was instructed not to race mix, just read the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, you will get your fill of racist talk and how Ezra and Nehemiah instructed the Israelites not to intermarry with these Canaanites. Okay? Any more thoughts on Genesis 15, 19 through 21?
No, we will later when we get past the promises to Abraham, and I'm sure that'll probably run into next week.
Yes, yes.
And we'll discuss them at length.
Okay. Let me just continue here in chapter 16, verse 8, because we want to make a distinction here between Ishmael and Isaac. Okay. Verse 9, And the angel of Yahweh, verse 8, and he said, Hagar, Sarai's maid, where came you, and where will you go? And she said, I flee from the face of my mistress Sarai. Why? Because Sarai told her to get lost, okay, and take her son Ishmael with her, okay? And the angel of Yahweh said to her, return to your mistress and submit yourself under her hand. And the angel of Yahweh said to her, I will multiply your seed exceedingly, that it shall not be numbered for multitude. Now, of course, we're talking about Ishmael, and the descendants of Ishmael are the Arabs.
Well, some of the Arabs.
Okay.
The word Arab means mixed.
Yes.
Ishmael was white. His mother was white.
Yes.
She was a Hamite. She was an Egyptian.
Right.
Abraham was white. Ishmael would have been white.
Mm-hmm.
And if Ishmael had married legitimate women, his children would have been white.
Right.
But the word Arab means mixed.
Mm-hmm.
And really, out of all the Arab tribes that I know, that I could speak for, the only Arab tribe that has a legitimate claim to descent from Ishmael are the Nabataeans.
Okay.
Who are currently found amongst the Jordanian people.
Okay.
And they're mixed, don't get me wrong.
Yes, they are.
But they have had the name from Nabaioth for demonstrably for thousands of years.
Okay.
Nabaioth is the son of Ishmael.
Okay, excellent, excellent. Okay, verse 11. And the angel of Yahweh said to her, behold, you are with child and shall bear a son and shall call his name Ishmael, because Yahweh has heard your affliction. And Ishmael will be a wild man. His hand will be against every man and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. So in the midst of what we call today Arabia, and probably, you know, some points east, some points west, and south and southeast, that's where the Arabs have lived all this time, haven't they? The descendants of Ishmael.
Yes, and there's indication that they were mixed at a very early time.
Right.
With other races.
Yes.
And with other tribes of Adamites.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like Sheber and those tribes.
Yes.
Sabians. And we discussed that last week, I believe, that Strabo mentioned the Sabians and the Nabataeans as dwelling together in the same places.
Right. Now, even here, it says that the descendants of Ishmael shall be great in number, and it shall not be numbered for multitude. That is the seed, the offspring of Ishmael. And so the same is true. The Arabs / Ishmaelites of the Middle East are far greater in number than the Jewish people. Okay, so we have two people here being talked about that are far greater in numbers of offspring than the Jews. The Jews have always been a small number of people, and Yahweh says that exactly about the Edomites, that they will never be an appreciably large population, but they will always, and the Edomites and the Canaanites have always mixed together, and it's these Edomites and Canaanites who are the enemies of Israel throughout the Bible. Isn't that correct?
Right. Esau took Ishmael. He took an Ishmaelite wife, and he took Canaanite wives, Hittite wives, and he also went and dwelt in Mount Seir amongst the Horites.
That's right. Okay. Which are another Canaanite people.
Yes.
Yes.
They're actually the Hivites of Genesis.
The Hivites. Okay,
the
right.
The Horites.
Yeah. Now, one fact, let me just jump back to Genesis 15:21, the Amorites. My understanding is that these Amorites were like the cave dwellers, the little people who dwelt in underground dwellings. And these people, and my understanding is that these people are still alive today in northern Turkey. People have reported seeing people poking their heads out of holes in the ground inside of caves, okay? These would be the Amorites, okay? They still exist. Okay.
They're actually prevalent, actually, in Sumerian inscriptions and Akkadian inscriptions later on.
Okay.
As a roaming people who dwelt west of Babylonia.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, in Genesis chapter 17, Yahweh repeats the covenant blessings and the covenant between himself and Abraham. Now, let me start in verse 4. As for me, behold, my covenant is with you. And you shall be a father of many nations. Now, I would ask, anybody listening, how many nations have the Jews fathered? One.
Maybe one.
Maybe the current Jew-Israeli state with Israelite money. Okay?
They stole that. That
they
was
stole
really
that.
Yeah, that was with British and American money.
Yeah.
You could call it true Israelite money.
Yeah. Now, the Jews are reluctant to quote this prophecy regarding Abraham because they haven't fathered many nations. They haven't fathered any nations. Even the one they have now is bought with Israelite money. Verse 5, neither shall your name anymore be called Abraham, but your name shall be Abraham. For a father of many nations have I made you. And that's the very meaning of the word Abraham, folks. So the Jews can't be Abrahamites because they haven't fathered any nations. Verse 6, and I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make nations of you, and kings shall come out of you. How many Jewish kings are there in this world?
Herod.
None. Yeah, Herod.
There were a few Herodian kings.
Yeah.
Few of them were appointed over petty kingdoms elsewhere outside of Judea.
Yeah.
But they didn't last, and they didn't amount to anything.
Well, the entire Herodian dynasty, from the day that the Romans appointed him co-regent with John Hyrcanus, which was probably like 80 B.C., maybe not quite that early, but in that vicinity. And then he lived, he reigned, I think, wasn't it 37 years, Herod reigned, until he died?
Yes, the first Herod at least 37 years.
Yes.
And you know, Josephus makes it very clear that he was an Edomite.
That's right.
Both sides of his family. Josephus repeats it at least four times
right.
in his histories.
Right, exactly. And, of course, all your Judeo-Christian ministers and Bible historians totally overlooked the fact that Herod was an Edomite.
Well, they haven't read Josephus.
Yes. Well, they totally disregard it because they want to pretend that Herod was a Judahite.
They've read handbooks on clinical psychology and diversity training. They
yeah,
haven't
exactly.
read Josephus.
So when Herod took the throne, he usurped it. It was not a continuation of the Hasmonean dynasty.
He killed off the last of the Hasmoneans, and he bribed Mark Antony with 900 talents of silver.
Right.
Which is a considerable amount of silver, because a talent weighs about 58 pounds.
And that's exactly how the Jews operate, isn't it? They
yes,
buy
it is.
Their way in.
All the time.
Yes. Verse 7, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your seed. There's that word seed again, folks. It's offspring. It has no other meaning in the Hebrew but offspring. After you in their generations. Now, folks, I'm just going to read verse 7 all the way through without interrupting. And you tell me if this doesn't say that the covenant between Yahweh and the seed of Abraham doesn't last forever. Verse 7, and I will establish my covenant between me and you and your seed after you in their generations, for an everlasting covenant to be a God to you and to your seed after you. Any indication of spiritual Israel here?
Not at all. And I would like to take this opportunity to quote two passages from my New Testament.
Okay.
And the first one is Luke 2:30-31. And it's Simeon. It's the prophecy of Simeon concerning the newborn Christ child
mm-hmm.
who he sees in a temple.
Yes.
And he says, because my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in front of all of the people, a light for the revelation of the nations and honor of your people Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's nothing like the King James translates it.
Yes.
However, I can defend the Greek is actually a grammatical construct called a hendiason, meaning one from or two from one.
Okay.
And the nations and the honor of the people Israel are one and the same thing, one and the same entity.
Yes. Okay.
And the Greek grammar in that insists on that, and I have notes at length on that perhaps I'll post.
Right.
Now the other. Passage I'd like to quote from my translation is Acts 9:15.
Okay.
And Paul says, and this is Yahshua speaking of Paul to the man who healed Paul's blindness after his road to Damascus event. He says, go, for he is a vessel chosen by me who is to bear my name before both the nations and
mm-hmm.
the kings of the sons of Israel.
Yes.
and a proper translation of the New Testament, and I could demonstrate that that says exactly what I translated it to say from the original Greek,
mm-hmm.
and a proper translation in the New Testament is not one step out of context with the Old Testament.
Right. That's right. Absolutely. Yes. And then the fact that the New Testament begins with Matthew's genealogy of Christ.
Right.
What's that genealogy doing there? What's that for?
All through Paul, all through the Revelation, this is the fulfillment of the promises
That's
of
right.
the Old Testament.
That's right.
As Luke also wrote in chapter 1,
mm-hmm.
that he came to fulfill the promises made to the fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And these promises...
Not
to
spiritual Israel or some church.
Right. These promises to Abraham that his nations and kings would come out of his loins,
yes.
they literally came true.
Exactly.
And it's our duty, if we want to claim to be Christians, or if we
yes.
want to attach ourselves to this book, it's our duty to demonstrate or to find out, to investigate, how these promises came true.
That's right.
And the only way to do that is through history and archaeology.
Yeah, and they haven't come through via the Jewish people, and they haven't come through via any so-called church. Okay.
No, they've only come through the Saxon and Celtic Germanic
right.
people that populated Europe and where they came from.
Absolutely right. Luke 1:54 and 55 tells us this, speaking of the coming of the Messiah, he has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham, and to his seed forever. Direct quote from Luke 1:55, going back to Genesis 17:7. So Luke obviously understood it wasn't talking about spiritual Israel. It was talking
Absolutely.
About the literal seed of Abraham.
So the church that tries to play this replacement theology,
yes.
the fullest replacement theology trick, they're not only denying the Old Testament, they're
mm-hmm.
denying the New.
That's exactly right.
The Testament that they claim to adhere to, they're denying.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we did a show talking about how Paul verifies that the promises would proceed through Isaac and not through Ishmael.
Right. When I organized my notes for this program this afternoon, and we may not get to
mm-hmm.
it until next
yeah,
week.
Yeah, because we only have a few minutes left. Yeah.
I had actually wanted to have that discussion in the end of Genesis chapter 17.
Okay. All right. we can wait because Sarah is her name has to be changed from Sarai to Sarah, and we can talk about that. Okay. So that we can fill people in on. Yeah, because there's all kinds of New Testament confirmation that these Old Testament prophecies have been literally fulfilled in a particular people and not by any replacement.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so all this replacement theology is nothing but Jewish rubbish, and you take a Jewish lie and hand it to a Judaic Christian, and he will take that baton and run right over the cliff with it.
Well, to maintain the lie of Jewish identity,
mm-hmm.
the church had to have a replacement theology.
That's right.
Or there's
right.
a direct conflict between who the people of the book are.
That's right. That's right. And the Jews don't fulfill any of these prophecies regarding Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Absolutely
well,
none of them.
And these prophecies are all well and good. There are much more direct prophecies in Genesis 49 and 50 concerning
absolutely.
The children of Israel, which they're much more explicit, and,
yes.
and the Jews definitely haven't fulfilled any of them either.
Yeah, because they concern the individual tribes, and the Jews aren't any of the tribes. In fact, it's Judaism, which is the replacement theology for the Old Testament.
Yeah.
That's the original.
Oh.
Yeah. And they themselves are the replacement people for true Israel. So if you want to talk about replacement theology, let's talk about Judaism.
They're trying to be anyway.
That's right. Verse 7, let's conclude on verse 7 here. And I will establish my covenant, because actually I read it, but I want to read it again, folks. And I will establish my covenant between me and you. He's talking right to Abraham. Yahweh Elohim is speaking right to Abraham, folks. Between me and you and your seed. Seed, folks. It doesn't say anything but descendants. It doesn't say anything about the religions that they practice. It doesn't say anything about any church. Between me and you and your seed, after you in their generations for an everlasting covenant forever, folks. Now, either these replacement theologians are liars or God is. Is there any other way to explain the difference between our theology and theirs, Bill Fink?
Well, that's pretty succinct.
Yeah. They're the ones who are teaching lies. And the whole Judeo-Christian world has believed these lies, just as Paul prophesied in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2 and 2 Timothy. These prophecies are New Testament prophecies as well. The whole world has believed the lie that the Jews are God's chosen people. The Israelites have forgotten their identity. The Anglo-Saxon people are the true Israel of the Bible. And that's reality, folks. That's the reality. And the Jews cannot, they don't even want to debate this issue. Because they know they will lose that because we're quoting Scripture, folks. And the Jews don't fulfill any of these prophecies. They know they're phonies. They know they're the children of the devil. And the fact is, just like Cain, the great deceiver, the son of the great deceiver, Nahash, the Jews are so good at deception, they have literally hoodwinked the whole world with this false teaching. That number one, that their religion is the religion of the Old Testament, which is a bold-faced lie, and that they and their people are the Israelites of the Bible, which is another bold-faced lie.
And in reality, in their own religion in the Talmud, they are their own Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
Because they know God isn't going to save them.
That's right.
They know those promises aren't to them.
Mm-hmm.
And Jews admit it today, and even rabbis admit it today, that the Jewish people are their own Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
And that's absolutely contrary to all of the writings in the Old Testament.
Exactly. Well, they have to say that because they do not accept Jesus Christ.
Right, and there's no other.
Yes, and there is no other Messiah.
They're admitting there is no other.
There's only one Messiah, and that's Jesus Christ. And the Jews flatter themselves when they say they're their own Messiah, but that's what they teach. Because who else would there be if they reject Yahshua Christ? Who else could they possibly have? They're in big trouble, folks. The judgment day is coming real soon, and the Jews aren't going to convert to Christianity. They're not capable of it. Because,
no,
as Jesus said himself, they are the children of the devil.
The evangelicals are absolutely deceiving themselves. If Yahshua Christ himself could not convert the Jews or the Edomites.
Yes.
To Christianity, and if he himself gave a parable saying that if they would have believed Moses and the prophets, they would have believed someone who returned from the dead.
Yes.
And proves it ahead of time that they wouldn't listen to him.
Right. They would kill him.
Who are they to think that Billy Graham could convert them?
That's right.
That's absolutely mad.
Yeah, he converted them to the false religion of Judeo-Christianity.
Or Joel Osteen or any of these other clowns.
Yeah, they're all clowns. Every last one of them are clowns. It's clownianity. That's what's going on in the world today, folks. It actually makes me sick to watch some of these clowns in operation. You know, I force myself to watch Osteen every once in a while to see if any truth comes out of his mouth.
Well, you know, I actually have one of his videos on my website.
Okay.
Because he actually did something good, I was shocked.
Oh, you were?
I have it in the discussion page on my website.
Uh-huh.
He actually came out against pork and shellfish.
Ah.
And said that they're unclean foods and that we still shouldn't be eating them.
Right.
And he gave a pretty good spiel about it.
Uh-huh.
So I put it on my website and I said, you know, it's a shame that the guy doesn't recognize the unclean creatures sitting in his audience.
That's right.
But he does deserve credit for the unclean food.
Yeah, well, I mean, hey, look, in order for your message to be at all credible, you have to preach the truth at least some of the time, you know, and say, here, this, I'm quoting it right from the Bible here, folks. You know, and then you twist it and distort it from that point, you know. But if you're telling lies all the time, then you can't be credible, you know. You have to have at least one or two true statements in the middle of your spiel to make yourself credible. And that's what they all do, you know. They will start with a true premise, and they will twist it and distort it and turn it backwards. Before the show's over, he's chomping down on pork chops, I guarantee you.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He probably went home and had his wife cook up some pork chops and some scallops. So, folks, these people are all liars. Judaism is a religion of lies. Judeo-Christianity is a religion of lies. As the Bible predicted, Revelation 12:9, the entire world, with the exception of the remnant, because the book of Revelation also says that the remnant are the only ones who would not be deceived. So that means only a very small number of people on this planet are not deceived. The whole world is deceived by these Jewish lies, pretending to be God's chosen people, Israel, pretending that Judaism is the religion of Moses. There is nothing, absolutely nothing, true about those two statements, folks. It's nothing but gargantuan lies promoted for the last 2,000 years by the rabbis of Judaism, who are the rabbis of Satan wearing the mask of Moses. That's what they are. Any words from you, Bill?
No, that's good by me.
Yeah, okay. All right, so, folks, we're going to continue this discussion, and believe me, folks, Genesis chapter 17 spells it out. Who these promises, who these covenants are made to. They're not made to the Jewish people. Abraham was not a Jew. If the etymology of the word Jew comes from the word Judah, Judah hasn't even been born yet, folks. Abraham cannot possibly be a Jew. He is an Adamite, a descendant of Noah through Shem. That's what Abraham is, folks. He is not a Jew, and the Shemites were Aryan people. They were not hook-nosed kikes. So you can see the extent to which this Bible has been convoluted, distorted, changed, and disrupted in every possible way by the rabbis of Judaism who have turned this book inside out. And the Bible predicts that people would not understand. The book of Daniel predicts that it would not be understood until the latter days, until the end times. Okay, even Martin Luther thought the Jews were Israel. He was fooled too. But he knew the Jews were evil. That's why he wrote the book, The Jews and Their Lies. He understood there was something wrong with them. He just really couldn't, you know, his question was, how could these Israelites turn against their own Messiah? Well, they're not even Israelites, folks. That's the explanation. All right. Okay, thank you, Bill.
Just before we leave,
yeah.
Love that Leah, she really wants to, she was only being sarcastic before with the universalistic remark.
Oh, I see.
And
okay.
She really didn't mean it.
Yeah, and I lost my screen. I wasn't able to follow. I don't know if there was any more discussion about that. If so, I couldn't get back on the chat room. So my apologies to Love That Leah. I took you seriously.
Well, we'll start with Genesis 17 and the rest of the promises to Abraham next week.
Excellent. Okay, great. All right,
Joe. Yahweh, and the pleasure's mine.
Praise Yahweh, and we'll be back tomorrow night with Yahweh's Covenant People, with Bill Fink and Pastor Ken Gregg. And Sunday, my guest will be Pastor George Udvari, and we're going to be talking about the feast days of the Hebrew calendar. I'm sure if you want to be a Bible-believing Christian, then you must practice the feast days, folks. So that's going to be our discussion on Sunday. Praise Yahweh.